Well, thank you, Ash, and thank you everybody for hanging in here. It's quite the daunting place to be at the end of two very intense days and after just a wonderful presentation from Alan. And I guess I can see perhaps why you might have put me in this slot, because you know, we have tried to recently move over to write a popular book around the economy. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about some of the work from that, and hopefully it will touch on a lot of the concepts, I think, that we've been discussing in the last 2 days. And it is pretty much, you know, our relatively idiosyncratic way we had of trying to think about how we might talk to a wider population, a wider public around what the commons are. Sorry, is something... Yeah, it just popped out. Oh, it's popped out. So I'm having trouble kind of figuring out how to move between one and the other. So thank you again for the invitation to be here. It's just wonderful. So I just want to set the background for my my work, because this lecture is informed by the work that Julie and I, as J.K. Gibson Graham, have been doing for many years and are continuing to do on rethinking the economy, and especially on how we represent capitalism. And so I've just put up this image of the Turkish translation of the book The End of Capitalism as We Knew It, A Feminist Critique of Political Economy. Now, you can speak Turkish now that I've translated that for you. Because I think it gets at the sense of what we tried to do in that book and what we've been trying to do ever since. And it's interesting that Ash brought up David and Goliath in his closing comments just before, because the Turks kind of took this old environmental, poster. There's capitalism as a big kind of robot eating up the earth, and there's Julie and I lobbing our little slingshots, the new co-feminist David trying to bring the Goliath down. Very different from the old Blackwell version that came out in 1996 that had Sisyphus rolling a stone up a hill and coming down on him. So I thought this was a bit more dynamic. But anyway, this kind of rethinking of economy has been very central to our academic and political work. And most recently, we published, just before Julie died, we started on this book, and we published it after she died in 2010, working also with Jenny Cameron and Stephen Healy, this very popular book called Take Back the Economy, An Ethical Guide for Transforming Our Communities. It's also published by Minnesota Press, and there's a website that's associated with the book. And in that book, we tried to take very everyday terms, understandings of economy, and reframe them in terms of what we call kind of a community economy, that takes ethical interdependence with each other and with Earth others seriously. So how do we start to reframe our economy and act on that? And the book is really about this kind of reframing, and it introduces tools and techniques to try and do this work. It also introduces a lot of examples from around the world of people who are trying to take back the economy in different ways. So what I'm going to talk about today is really some of the thinking that's in the Take Back Property chapter, where the issue of commoning becomes our ethical kind of move. Let's talk about what we have, what it is that supports life that we call property, and how do we start to take it back and common it. So I want to start with a quote by Massimo De Angelis and David Harvey, not the David Harvey you're all thinking of, another David Harvey, in their chapter on the commons in the Routledge Alternative Organisation Handbook that just came out. And they say that in spite of capital's strategies to deploy a commons fix to its problems, commons may well be part of a different historical trajectory. So the idea that commons and commoning might have a different historical trajectory is, I think, an interesting one. In other words, a different historical trajectory that's not tied into the narrative of enclosure and capitalist accumulation. This, I think, is a radical suggestion, especially today, when scholars are increasingly positioning the commons as a counterpoint to capital. And so I'd like to suggest that there's a kind of capitalocentrism that pervades contemporary discussions of commoning, of commons, and that it's that particular kind of discursive construction is preventing a full appreciation of the radical heterogeneity and political potential of commoning. So the emphasis on capital and its needs for a commons obscures the communities who make and share a commons through practices of commoning. I very much agree with Eduardo talking about that shift that we have to think of commons in terms of a practice of commoning. The different historical trajectory of commoning can only, I think, be revealed when we release the hold of hegemonic capitalocentric discourse and begin to read for difference. We can then learn from how communities of those who have little in common, those who have much in common, those operating at different scales over the millennia, and certainly before and during the emergence of capitalist modes of production, have been and are continually commoning. That is, making, negotiating, sharing, and sustaining that which provides material and immaterial nourishment. So navigating the challenges of commoning is what, for me, constitutes a post-capitalist politics for our times. In the climate-changing world of today that we've just heard about, we humans are being called upon to act as a species within the multi-species community of life on this planet. And here I'm drawing on the terms that Dipesh Chakrabarty has called us to think about, and also Deb Bird Rose talks about multi-species life. My concern is that contemporary scholarship is failing to respond to this call effectively, and that it's my contention then that a capitalocentric approach to the commons stands in the way of developing a politics of commoning that might encourage or rekindle our ability to act for life now and in the future. So for those of you who have never heard of it before, the term capitalocentrism was coined by J.K. Gibson Graham, my joint authorial presence with Julie, when we extended the feminist theorization of phalogocentrism to the field of economy to name the way in which a diversity of economic relations are always positioned in discourse as either the same as, a complement to, the opposite of, or somehow subordinated to, or contained within capitalism. And here you can see the way in which woman has often been positioned with respect to man in the same kind of centric kind of discourse. So, for example, when the binary capitalist private property and common property is invoked, we're all clear which is the dominant and which is the subordinate term. And when commons, capitalism, and enclosure are linked in the same breath, we see practices of commoning drawn into a discourse that places capital at the gravitational centre of meaning-making. The effect of this widespread mode of theorising effectively denies forms of economic difference, like a commons, any independent identity or effectivity or dynamism. And I think, as is now well understood, the power of such representation is materialised in pervasive technologies of capture, from legal systems to affective regimes. So the discussion of commons, I think, is often caught up in this knowledge power matrix. And for many, knowledge, many of those coming out of the kind of left political economy that certainly dominated economic geography for the last 20 years, knowledge of the commons is derived from Marx's influential historical account in Capital, Volume 1, of the land enclosures that accompanied the rise of capitalist agriculture and industry, particularly in Britain. In Marx's writing, the historical events of clearance, enclosure, and legal capture of common property are distilled and abstracted into the theory of primitive accumulation. Subsequent Marxists have noted the need of the capitalist system to sustain its extensive growth by continually finding and enclosing new commons, thus advancing an added dimension to the theory of capital accumulation, in which so-called primitive accumulation is ongoing. So as De Angelis and Harvey say, primitive accumulation and commons co-option seem to be the two complementary coordinates of a new capitalist strategy, an ongoing capitalist strategy and still happening today. And I think we could see examples of that kind of narrative in the stories that, and research that we heard presented in the last 2 days. But commons and capitalism are not only linked via the process of land enclosure. With the rise of the networked information economy, Michael Hart and Tony Negri highlight the central role that the common or shared immaterial property, that is ideas, images, knowledges, codes, languages, and affects, now play in capitalist production. The conundrum that they point to is that capitalist productivity is restricted when these forms of immaterial property are controlled and privatized. So they have a very interesting argument about the commons as being central to capitalist expansion. As the commons becomes increasingly central to capitalist production, they argue, capital's own development provides the tools of liberation from capital. So here they are calling on a very reassuring teleology. Hart and Negri see capital as creating its own gravediggers, as common immaterial property and its productive circuits become increasingly autonomous. So I think I've just briefly outlined then two kind of capitalocentric formulations, what De Angelis and Harvey calls the commons within and for capital and commoning beyond capital, but in service of capital. What they call the ambiguous razor edge that both capital and social movements must attempt to negotiate. And I think clearly there's a lot to commend in these very strong formulations. Not least being the sense of outrage that the enclosure analysis elicits and the kind of elusive hopes of an emergent communism that the gravedigger account kindles. But while the political sentiments of present outrage and hope for future emancipation clearly retain mobilising force, they don't offer me any ways towards the kinds of politics that will help us, and here I'm quoting Val Plumwood, go on onwards in a different mode of humanity. Val wrote not long before she died that if our species does not survive the ecological crisis, it'll probably be due to our failure to imagine and work out new ways to live with the earth, to rework ourselves and our high energy, high consumption and hyper instrumental societies adaptively. She says, we'll go on in a different mode of humanity or not at all. And those, to me, have been very powerful and galvanising words. And I think that the kind of capitalocentric vision of commons, it doesn't help me, as I said, go on to try and think about these crises in new ways. The story that they tell is still all about capitalism and resistance and somehow the nowhere of utopia. So I prefer to think of commons in a more than capitalist world, outside the confines and strictures of capitalocentrism. And I want to give you a sense of how. So I want to start with a definition that places the emphasis on the doing of a commons. And here I've been very inspired, or Julie and I were very inspired by Stephen Gudeman's economic anthropological writings, where he argues that the commons can be seen as what a community makes and shares to ensure its survival. And here I think, you know, obviously the term community, everybody's hackles will rise, but the way we've tried to use this is to a sense of a community that includes the more than human, that has this sense of being in common as its core, as opposed to a notion of a known community of sameness. So our survival obviously depends on many different kinds of commons, including the biophysical commons, as we heard about at the opening of the two-day symposium, the soil, water, air, plant and animal ecologies, also technologies and buildings. The cultural commons, language, musical heritage, sacred symbols and artworks, the social commons, the educational, health and political systems that we're part of, and the knowledge commons, the both indigenous ecological knowledge and scientific and technical knowledge. And I think we've heard papers over the last 2 days that take many of these different kinds of commons and really explore what's happening. So commons are continually made and remade. They're drawn down and replenished. They're maintained or degraded. And what happens to a commons depends on whether a community cares for and shares the thing that sustains it, or whether it exploits or neglects it. A loss of a commons is a loss of community. So this is the insight that Gareth Hardin really only came to in hindsight, some 30 years after coining the phrase, the tragedy of the commons. That phrase that, you know, is that little horrible wiggle worm that's always there that became a standard ideological shorthand for the inefficiency and unviability of any form of commonly held resource. As Hardin admitted in 1998, to judge from the critical literature, he said, the weightiest mistake in my synthesizing paper was the omission of the modifying adjective unmanaged. So what Hardin had analysed was an open access pasture, an unmanaged commons where there was no community that cared for the pasture and took responsibility for it, no community that organised herder access, that negotiated grazing use and oversaw the distribution of benefit to community members. An unmanaged commons where help yourself or feel free attitudes prevail, as Hardin wrote in 1998, is indeed a tragedy. But as Nobel Prize winner Eleanor Ostrom's research showed, managed commons have been resilient examples of long-term community benefit. Commoning involves then the process, for us at least, or more often the struggle, to make and share, to negotiate access, to care for, to responsibly manage and benefit from what sustains a community. The question of who owns a commons is open. Ownership of property is largely a legal matter and need not deter land or other resources from being accessed and managed as a commons. And here, this is the kind of the diverse economy kind of framing that we've used in much of our work, where we look at the ways in which that dominant term at the top, private property or capitalist private property, is underpinned by a whole range of other kinds of economic practices. And in this case, we're trying to look at the diversity of property ownership forms. When property is seen as a relationship between people with respect to things, all forms of property can potentially be common. Indeed, when the emphasis is on the community practice of commoning, it's clear that a commons can be created with any type of property, whether it's private property that might be owned by an individual owner, a family, a corporation, or a collective, or state-owned property, or open access property. When property ownership is taken as the theoretical entry point, though, it's tempting to construct a simple homology, and that's what Michael Hart does in his work on communism and the common, in which somehow private property is to capitalism, as state-owned property is to socialism, as common property is to primitive and future forms of communism. And this thinking strategy not only privileges formal abstract legalities at the expense of actual community practices, but then precludes the kinds of politics that imagines and enacts other worlds, other possible worlds here and now. In contrast, an anti-capitalocentric approach attends to the diversity of commoning practices with respect to property and allows us to chart a different historical trajectory of the commons. Whether commons are shrinking or growing becomes an empirical question. We're less inclined to read their decrease alongside dominant narratives of capital's need to enclose land and resources, or their increase with capital's newfound ability to manipulate shared immaterial labour. We're encouraged to reveal the choices that we make about what to foreground and to narrativise in our history making. Keeping in mind the performative political effects of our research, focus can shift away from objects and property regimes towards the creation and destruction of various types of community who are negotiating ways of being in common. So, in service to that kind of open stance, what we've done in our book is try and present a commons identikit. And the identikit is to say, well, we can use this kind of these sets of issues to find out whether a different kind of property, whether it's owned private property, it's owned by the state or is open access, is in the process of being commoned. Is access shared and wide? Is there some kind of use that's negotiated by a community? Is there a benefit that's widely distributed to the community members and possibly beyond? Is there care performed by a community by community members? And is there some kind of responsibility assumed by those members? And this kind of identikit is being used all around the place to map commons and sites of commoning action in cities like in Australia and in other parts of the world where people have taken up this kind of framework. Just for those of you who remember the old time geography diagrams of Hagerstrand, we've actually used this kind of mechanism to say, well, let's just think about your life in the last 24 hours. You wake up at home. Is your home privately owned? Is it a rented home, but is it commoned? How is it that you share those resources? This is a fictitious kind of day in the life of Bill and Sue, a coal miner and his wife living in a coal mining community, where they move through different kinds of property regimes through their 24 hours. To that kind of experience, we can then say, which of these spaces are commoned? Using the identikit, asking those questions. Which forms of property here are shared and why? Shared widely with a community or a household? Which kind of property, what kind of use is being negotiated? Who gets to negotiate it and so on? And so to use the identikit, we could take the different spaces that seem to be commoned in this particular trajectory. The primary school, for instance, where access is organised by teachers, children and parents, but the community has some kind of role in using the space, benefiting from the space, and take some responsibility for maintaining the school. They might have a kitchen garden or some kind of working bee regularly. But it's state-owned property. I think if you were to ask the same questions of high schools in Australia, you might feel that they're not commoned because the relationship to a wider community of students and teachers and parents rarely occurs. In this case, the football club was definitely a privately and collectively owned property that was part of a commons in which people shared work and labour to make sure that the thing worked, etc. In the case here, we include also Sue's involvement with open access Photoshop and various things. She's an artist using Wikipedia, which is another form of a community that relies on volunteer administrators and has sort of rules of use. So this is kind of one of the techniques to try and help people interrogate the ways in which commons are all around us, that we are already involved in commoning. We might not see them in those terms, but our agenda is here is to say, actually, we're already involved in ethical relationships around property. Let's bring them to the fore. And we could, even in this case, we can unpack that idea that private property isn't commoned. We could even imagine, for instance, a gated community. As Nick said, it's a form of commons. But of course, usually it's quite constrained in terms of who gets to use it. The boundaries are set up. But I just heard of a very interesting gated community in Western Sydney that has wonderful water features that the local kids come from outside the gated community when it's a hot day and jump around in the water features because they don't have a bus to get to the swimming pool. And of course, that's raised a whole set of issues around whether they have rights to that use or not. And that's the negotiation. That's the inclusion-exclusion that is always going to happen when any kind of community tries to either police its commons or enlarge its commons. So this kind of identikit we've also used to try and specify what's involved in different ways of commoning, which can involve both commoning enclosed property, like the kids are trying to do by running in and jumping in the water features of the gated community. They're saying, let's not have such narrow access to these resources, you know, let's be part of a commons. We can also think about creating new commons, just as is happening all over the world, in community gardens, in areas of public access where people are starting to take care and grow food, such as Detroit, we've heard examples of. And there's also the commoning of unmanaged open access land or resources. And this kind of commoning can take place, I think, with communities that are not just human, but also human and more than human. And in the book, we talk about the Flashjack Commons, which is a particular commoning of private property, large properties in the Brigalow scrub of Queensland, where whole communities of shooters and environmentalists and the property owners themselves have come together to care for an endangered species of small wallaby. And the wallaby is obviously part of that commons. It's benefiting from the ways in which that property is now being managed. It's under a covenant. There's some kind of quasi-legal relationship now that enshrines their right to that particular land. So what I want to do in the remainder of the talk is just to discuss this third category, this commoning of unmanaged open access resources, because I think I'd like to discuss how we might think about the atmosphere in this way. Clearly, a resource of immense significance to planetary survival, one that can never be completely enclosed or owned, but one that can be cared for and potentially managed as a commons. So I want to talk about commoning for a post-capitalist future. This is one of the sculptures by the sea in Sydney the year before last. I take a double take when I look at that. But perhaps this is an indication of what our future commons holds. Well, it's daily ever more evident that we humans lack of ability to common our atmosphere, that is, to take care for it, to take responsibility for it, for what presently exists as an open access, unmanaged resource, is threatening our very existence and that of countless other species. As countries such as my own continue to refuse to act to reduce carbon emissions and address global warming, Hardin's tragedy of the unmanaged commons comes back to haunt us in the form of super droughts, super floods, unprecedented temperatures, accelerated species extinctions, and wild winds whipped up over a warming ocean. In a recent lecture, Bruno Latour has called it the Australian strategy of voluntarily sleepwalking towards catastrophe. And he's right. But while our public officials continue their inaction, rewarded by the bribes of the mining industry and silenced by the threats of the Murdoch press, as Natalie talked about yesterday, citizens are engaged in innovative practices of commoning, building communities and counterpublics in which care for country, other species, for atmosphere and future generations is paramount. And one way of tracking then the historical trajectory of commoning practices is to use another tool that we have in the book, what we call a commons yardstick. This is a simple device which helps us to record our relationships to commoning over a time period that places our present in the kind of temporal context that climate change requires us to consider. And on it we can record the actions of enclosure or commoning that have, in previous generations, contributed to current levels of well-being for some and disadvantage for others. And we can look forward, what we've done here is trying to say, it's almost like trying to appeal to people as affective subjects. I mean, we can kind of remember perhaps back to our grandparents' lives and perhaps even from their stories of their parents' lives. We have some connection back perhaps 75 years if we think of a generation of 25. But we can also start to think forward, perhaps. And here we're saying, let's just think forward not just to our children's lifespan, the one that's going to see all black water on the northern Arctic, but that of seven generations hence, guided by the kind of planning philosophy that's practiced by many Indigenous societies. If we take a generation to be 25 years, we can locate commoning and uncommoning activities in the past and present and attempt to predict forward 150 years into the future. And I want to kind of use this device to track the faltering ways that humans in very different collectivities at varying scales are commoning our atmosphere, forging ways of acting as a multi-species planetary community of those who, while they seem to have nothing in common, share the bodily need for clean and coolish air to thrive. So we know that our atmosphere has been becoming more and more polluted and our climate has been warming since at least the 1860s, way back there with that hands pointing. That is for six generations. Sometime around the 50s, there was some kind of scientific evidence of what was happening in terms of global warming, but it wasn't a generalized observation. But over that period, that long period, we've come to know that this precious protective layer of what we call air has been the quintessential example of a tragically unmanaged open access resource. Yet there have been moments in which communities of care have formed to common this basic life support. For example, the community response to the Great London Smog of 1952 and the 12,000 deaths that were attributed to it led to a movement to common the atmosphere by taking responsibility for air quality, for regulating burning behaviour, and distributing the benefit to all in the form of breathable air and reduced death rates. The Clean Air Acts that were passed in the UK in the late 1950s were followed by similar legislation in other countries and ongoing processes to monitor air quality, particularly the effects of acid rain. Another case is that of the international community response to the depletion of the ozone layer by chlorofluorocarbons. This came again some 75 years or three generations after the introduction of these chemicals into the manufacturing of refrigerators, air conditioners and aerosols in the 1920s. And this is, I think, perhaps one of the most successful cases to date of atmospheric commoning. The Montreal Protocol banning the use of CFCs that deplete the ozone layer was first formulated in 1987, and it's taken at least one generation, that is until 2010, for all countries of the world to sign up to it. The ozone hole is supposedly shrinking, but scientists predict that we'll have to wait until at least 2070, or two more generations hence, for it to be completely repaired and the threat of increased likelihood of skin cancers and all the other effects of ozone, the ozone hole lessened. This is something that of great importance to us in Australia and New Zealand, where the effects of this are very potent. So here we see an attempt to try and start to replenish the commons, to address degradation. Such promising evidence of global and national communities acting to common aspects of our atmosphere stand, however, I think, in stark contrast to the current impasse with respect to international agreements to halt global warming, an even more serious threat to survival on this planet. Yet on-the-ground practices of commoning led by households and citizen groups offer some hope. As it sleeps walk to catastrophe, Australia continues to export and burn black and brown coal, which by the geological luck of the draw, it has in copious quantities. During the 20th century, national industrial development was built on the provision of cheap, coal-fired electricity delivered to businesses and residential consumers by state government-owned monopolies. In the interwar period and post-war periods, a transmission grid and distribution network was built, again with public funding, to deliver electricity from centralised power sources located on the coal fields of each state to consumers concentrated in cities. And this replaced the kind of more decentralised network of local municipal and town power stations. And this arrangement wasn't disrupted, really, until the late 1980s, when, with the rise of neoliberal public policies championed by conservative political forces, the state monopolies were broken into component parts: generation, transmission, distribution and retailing. And in Victoria, that happened in the 80s, when I actually then started to do a big action research with retrenched workers and so on in the Latrobe Valley. So the power stations were separated into individual businesses and forced to compete in a national wholesale market for electricity. And some, mainly in the state of Victoria, were privatised, while the transmission grid and distribution network has remained until now publicly owned. Over the last 25 years, state politics has been galvanised into the anti-privatisation and pro-economic rationalism camps, and bitter debates have ensued, and it's brought down a few state governments in that period. And by the way, contrary to the prediction of all the neoliberal economists and policy advisers, recent research commissioned by the Anti-Privatisation Electrical Trades Union has shown that power prices actually rose after privatisation and consumers were no better off. Of course, the rhetoric was the opposite. But the argument over public versus private ownership of the energy industry in Australia which is sometimes cast in terms of this commons versus capital dichotomy, has raged with barely a nod to what I'll call the mammoth in the room, a Neanderthal commitment by all political parties, other than the Greens, to burning coal in a country that has actually led solar energy research since the 1970s and, of course, has abundant sunlight. So looking back, we see an electricity industry and the coal owned by that was owned by the state and in many cases actually coal mines owned by the state that was originally conceived as a publicly owned commons that would provide a flow of benefits to all sectors of the Australian community. The industrialists who needed cheap and reliable power, the massive labour force of state employees who were granted lifelong secure jobs, and the household consumers who gained access to efficiently delivered power. But somewhere over this 100-year or four-generation history, there have been moments of uncommoning as the disparate communities that originally shared a vision of state development and a common electricity industry have fractured. Vested business interests, as particularly in the manufacturing and metal smelting industries, have increasingly commandeered the benefit flows of this state-owned resource via secretly negotiated low prices designed to attract and subsidise industry. And the community has awoken to the damage that coal-fired power generation causes. This is basically that same place just this year, where a huge fire broke out in the brown coal mines of Morwell. And it raged for more than 3 weeks. The state refused to call a state of emergency, so all the people living in this area didn't have any access to leave. I mean, they were said, oh, go and stay in your holiday house, but all these people are quite poor. They're not exactly have accessible other houses. And we're going to see an incredible health spike of probably of cancers and all sorts of things in the coming years as a result. And this this occurrence really took place because the privatised coal mining the company, foreign-owned company, and electricity station really had not been keeping up with its maintenance and dampening down of the coal resource. But despite this, this kind of thing and this kind of evidence of the impact, the very immediate impact of this coal mining, but obviously the atmospheric impact, still workers and their unions linked to coal mining and electricity generation have, for the most part, resolutely refused to question the sense of defending a power industry that is destroying our atmosphere. The politics of privatisation is thus fraught with entrenched ideological positioning along last century class lines between industry and trade unionism, or trade unions, and a deep ambivalence on the part of much of the public. But meanwhile, a grassroots movement of household solar power generators is actually reshaping the energy sector, threatening to render coal-fired power stations and the poles and wires of the electricity grid into a stranded asset. And you can see in the distance there those poles and wires, which are under the discussion of the state wants to sell them off at the moment. Nobody wants them because of what's happening in the energy sector. The massive switch to solar power across the Australian suburbs has been driven by a number of incentives and motivations. One was the subsidised price of solar panels introduced by the federal government as part of a strategy to avert the GFC. And this resulted in a huge surge, especially in lower income areas, of households getting solar panels attached to their roofs. Another was the attraction of state-based feed-in tariff incentives offering income-generating opportunities for householders producing excess power. But along with these incentives, there's been growing concern, obviously, for global warming and a willingness to play a part in reducing global carbon emissions. And the technical ability to closely monitor household energy accounts on an hourly basis for the raw wattage coming in and a monthly basis for dollar values offers another kind of unexpected incentive, which has inspired a societal reduction in energy usage as people shift their habits and see their, albeit minuscule, contribution to carbon reduction in the real time of their own lifespan. And here, I think we really need to think about these socio-technical assemblages that we talked about through the last 2 days, you know, really taking hold. And this is some stills from a wonderful program called the Carbon Cops, where various environmental scientists went around to households to help them install various monitors to measure their carbon footprint. You know, a problematic issue, but it had a lot of impact. And they're all looking around at this monitor that's telling them when they're going over the average Australian carbon footprint and when they're under. And the kind of, and you know, having just installed solar panels, I do that with the little thing we have that tells us at any moment how much sun's coming in and how much we're using. It's a kind of, techno romance that's happening. It reminds me, or someone said, well, it's probably like when women move from, you know, wood-burning stoves to having stoves that actually had thermometers on them. They had to kind of recalibrate what it meant to put in the sponge at this degree and that degree and something. Now we do the same thing. We put our dishwasher on at this time, not the other. Okay, so I'm ending up now. From all these kind of motivations, a community of atmospheric commoners has emerged. The movement in Australia, Solar Citizens, is one public face of this community. And just a few weeks ago, this group presented a petition to keep solar strong, signed by about 20,000 Australians, in a show of support for the 20% renewable energy target that the Abbott government is about to renew and potentially revise. But behind this more vocal public lies a much larger number of community consumer producers, or prosumers, reaching up to about a million solar homes as of April 2013, whose actions have started to affect energy markets, bringing the price of photovoltaic solar panels down and a system-wide reduction in electricity demand. In the last 5 years since 2009, or just one-fifth of a generation, electricity demand has dropped 7%. So, and I think there's an interesting way in which markets can actually be a way of harnessing this collective effort and start to amplify it and start to have an impact on industries that are recalcitrant in the face of climate change. Another part of the story is a whole group of engineers and other activists who've got together to actually produce a whole scenario for zero emissions Australia in 2020 with various kinds of solar generation and a new kind of grid. So there is this incredibly detailed technical report that is circulating and is the object of much discussion, as saying, you know, with something like a 3% of GDP commitment of investment, we could actually be carbon neutral through our energy, at least, only by 2020. Another one of these kind of inputs of scientific knowledge with a real groundswell of vernacular interest in doing things differently. So new practices of accessing, using, benefiting from, caring for, and taking responsibility for solar power generation are constituting different communities, ones that are making and sharing an electricity commons. In turn, while intergovernmental and legal efforts to care for the atmosphere falter, these complex on-the-ground actions of new collectivities, driven by multiple motivations, not least of which is the hip pocket, as well as the sense of altruistic relationship to Earth others, these things offer a way forward towards atmospheric commoning. And this, I think, is just one glimpse. I could have done many others or different ones, and the book has lots of other ones, of what I'll call everyday commoning, that an anti-capital-centric language of the commons brings to visibility. These glimmers invigorate a politics of commoning capable of starting now to build the future in which our descendants 7 generations hence will be able to thrive in. Post-capitalist practices of commoning may indeed, I think, create a different historical trajectory. Thank you.